Welcome to the AquariMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 125, recorded August 6th, 2012.
Greetings, AquariMaxers.
Hello.
So what have we got lined up for today?
Well, we have a few things from Mick, and then we have some things of our own to talk about.
So Mick in Conforth, UK?
Yes, the Mick. What other Mick would I be talking about? We love Mick.
So what's up?
Mick sent us a kind of a funny picture. It was cute. It was a hermit crab, but in a different kind of shell. It says it's from the New Zealand Marine Studies Center, and they put glass shells into the hermit crab tank. And then the crabs moved into the shells so that the scientists could see through it and they could study them more. But they took a very good picture of this hermit crab in a glass see-through shell.
Cool. Yeah, I've seen that. It's pretty amazing that you can make a shell to a hermit crab's satisfaction and that they'll actually live in it. It's kind of neat.
Now you were telling me that's difficult because hermit crabs are picky. They have certain requirements about shells.
They are, and it depends on the species, but... For example, terrestrial hermit crabs, which I have some experience with, different species prefer different shells, and when they do get the shell, sometimes they'll modify the shell with their pinchers. They'll actually remove inner portions of the shell to make it suit them better and so on. So being able
to... get a renovation loan for that?
Yeah, something like that. So being able to produce a model that is satisfactory to a hermit crab is something of an accomplishment.
And you said there was something about how they like to block up the entrance too.
Yeah, when they block up the entrance of the shell for protection, they use different parts of their body depending on the different species. Most of them use their larger claw or chelipede, a portion of that as kind of a shield, and then different species also use parts of their legs. And some species, their walking legs will overlap the claw. In other cases, they'll be behind it or to the side of it, and so on. Different configurations, and so they like different shaped openings. Some prefer more oval openings, others more round openings, and so on.
Depending on what they want to block it with.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's pretty amazing that they made some that they would like, then.
It is.
So, is it up on our...
Yeah, I found a link to the same picture. Yeah, I think it's a different link, but same picture.
So is it on our Facebook page?
No, it's on the show page.
Show page, so you can go and see it. It's kind of cool.
It is.
It's neat. Mick also sent us two video links. One of them of his little marine hermit crab, speaking of hermit crabs. And it's funny because it's this little tiny crab, and he's trying to get up, like he's on, not on his back, but on the shell, as if the shell were his back, you know what I mean? And then he's trying to get up and stand up on the sand, and it takes him a little while because he's this little tiny crab in his big old shell.
But he manages.
He does. So that's cute. And the other one... Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say that I embedded that on the show page.
Both of them? Both
yeah,
the videos?
Both
okay,
videos.
Good. You should just put a link up on the Facebook page too.
Yeah.
It's easy. And the other one is his young axolotls.
Yes.
It looked like there was five of them in the tank, I think.
Or at least five we could see in the shot.
Yeah. They didn't look albino because their eyes were dark.
Right, and there are a couple of different color varieties of axolotls, to my knowledge, which I think are extinct in their native habitat.
Which is what?
Some lakes in Mexico, or a lake in Mexico, something like that. Hmm. But they've been kept in labs and so on for decades and as pets. And so there are various color varieties out there. I suspect the ones that Mick has are maybe leucistic or maybe hypomelanistic or something.
But they're white.
Because they have, they have dark eyes. Mm-hmm. Looks like they have pigment in their eyes. But yeah, they're about 2 inches long, you said, and they're looking good.
And they're feeding on white worms in the video, and it's just so funny to see these. They swim like a fish, and then they walk like a salamander on the bottom, and it's so incongruous. It's very amusing.
Yeah.
They're very cute.
They are. And we were talking about them before a bit. Kelly was asking about them, and we were talking about how they're neotenic, which means they have... their larval form is their reproductive form, and in this particular species, they don't have a terrestrial adult form. They're very closely
they don't turn
related
into a
to
a salamander.
Right. They don't turn into a terrestrial salamander. They remain larval in terms of their external gills and the finnage on their tail and so on. But they become sexually mature. And this is it's interesting that there's a species, and there are other species like this. Quite a number of species of salamander share that characteristic. But it's just an interesting phenomenon that they can do that. And there are some species, a closely related species, the tiger salamander, and I have kept the larval form and the terrestrial form of tiger salamander before. It's the same genus, actually. It's Ambystoma tigrinum as opposed to Ambystoma mexicanum, which is the axolotl. And they do have some populations where either all or some of the population remains in the larval form and reproduces in that form.
Why?
And
why?
Why would that happen?
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Well,
was that the original form of salamander, and then different forms of salamander came about that went on land, or
likely,
or these kind of a regression?
It's likely that they are descended from salamanders that originally were transformed into terrestrial salamanders, but that the conditions were such that that was not a survival advantage, I guess. The
what are the chances of having, I don't know, obviously it happened, but
mm-hmm.
the conditions aren't good outside of the water for turning into a terrestrial salamander, and so you just happen to get individuals that mutate so that they can reproduce while they're still larval. That's weird.
it sounds weird. It's probably not that hard for such a thing to arise, because it wouldn't take much of a mutation for certain processes to be set in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And we could talk about this more in depth, I suppose, but maybe it's beyond the scope of the podcast. But basically, it's not a big jump to go from reproducing as a larval salamander to reproducing to, and from not being able to reproduce as a larval salamander to being able to do it. Developmentally, it's a big change in a way, but genetically, it's not a big change that would cause that to start happening. And because it's happened in many different species of salamander, it's probably something that just happens once in a while in most populations of salamanders.
Fairly common mutation, you mean?
Probably. This is speculation, but probably it happens often enough that it's been able to arise independently in different lineages of salamanders. It must happen often enough that it's, you know, when it is a survival advantage, it occurs. One thing is that the lakes in which the axolotls live in the wild, or lived, I guess, they're fairly high in elevation, I think, and so the water's not that warm. And the area around is, I don't think, particularly hospitable.
Just a desert?
Salamanders now. I'm not sure. I don't know too much about it, but these deep, cool lakes are a pretty good place to exist as a larval salamander. Fairly constant food supply. I'm sure the temperature doesn't change drastically,
mm-hmm.
you know, and with the seasons and so on. So it's a pretty good place to be a larval salamander. There are also alpine lakes, as I understand it, in places where the tiger salamander lives, where the populations, as I was saying, remain larval. And I've captured alpine salamanders before, or tiger salamanders in the past, and then they have immediately begun to metamorphose, and I have wondered...
Because you kept them out of the water?
Because I captured them. I didn't keep them out of water, but...
Going
from this lake into a conceivably probably much warmer environment indoors in an aquarium... And this drastic change
and
may
they turned
have,
into a salamander.
They all turned into salamanders.
So they still apparently possess the possibility, but there's something environmental that keeps them from...
Right, and I believe that axolotls have been induced to take the terrestrial form, even though it never occurs in the wild form, as far as we know.
So is it temperature?
And I believe they've done it with thyroid extract. I could be wrong.
Hmm.
There may have been other ways.
Well, you didn't do it with thyroid extract,
No, I
though.
Didn't. I didn't.
What
and
do you think it was?
Probably just the temperature change or other environmental changes. I'm not sure. And it could have been that the populations that I took mine from were about to change anyway. I mean, that's possible. And I do know that in many places in the state there are population of tiger salamanders that do metamorphose. So it's difficult to say. But it's interesting anyway to think about.
It's funky stuff.
It is.
Okay, he also has a few other things to say to us. He says, the mini marine has cycled fully, and last week I added an algae blenny and a frag of pulsing zinnia. I hope to add a few more red leg hermits in the next couple of weeks.
Wow. That pulsing zinnia stuff is weird.
What is it?
It's a coral. Like? And it's coral on these little stalks, and then there's kind of a palmate structure at the end, you know, like feathery tendrils coming out.
Fronds?
Yeah, looking like that. That's what it looks like. They remind me sort of little palm trees, vaguely.
Okay.
But they're just these little, it's a coral, and they move. You know, most corals sort of sway with the current. Uh-huh. These zinnia, at least under certain conditions, the little head.
Open, close?
Open and close, yeah.
Huh.
The little palmate structure at the end there.
Weird.
So they're interesting.
This is my wife. Oh, sorry, did you have something else to say?
No, just that I like algae blennies.
Okay.
Remember Roger the Shrubber?
Oh, okay, yes.
He's one.
He was awesome.
Yeah, they have a lot of personality.
Okay, and then he says, my white pearl shrimp have finally had babies, which are feeding in the algae on the back tank glass. I deliberately don't clean the back glass, so there is a steady supply for the shrimp. With the white ones, it also makes it easy to see them against the green.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. I guess if you had green shrimp, it would make it harder, but with white shrimp, it works well.
So they look like little snowflakes in the algae, right?
Yeah.
He says, fantastic news on your betta fry. Love that you dedicated the last show to it. Keep us all posted as things go, which we will. I think we're going to talk a little bit more.
Yeah, we'll give a little bit more
about that today.
About it today. Mm-hmm.
Oh, and this is funny. Okay, I don't remember how I got on this tangent last time or whatever time it was, but I was talking about Russ's anomiaphasia where he always calls corn on the cob chicken unless he's concentrating really hard. And Mick says that he always thinks Sunday but says Thursday. So he's got the same little funky switch there. He says, after hearing Russ is also affected by this, I can only conclude it is a sign of genius. I would agree.
Oh, that sounds good to me. If it works, I'll take it.
Okay, thank you, Mick. That was lovely stuff. And we are, in fact, now going to give you a little update on the baby bettas.
Yeah. Some interesting things we noticed. One is that the size difference has increased quite a bit with certain individuals. We've noticed some iridescence showing up on some of the larger individuals too, which sounds like a good thing. We hope it proves to be a good thing. I'm sure we'll see more as that develops what sort of coloration we get, but seeing as the parents are largely white, hopefully we'll get some nice iridescent white bodies. An interesting phenomenon with the Daphne, I mentioned last week, I had several Daphne in there. Over the past couple of days, I noticed the fish chasing the Daphne, even though they were much too big to eat. But today, I looked in there, not a single Daphne.
Oh, they're finally big enough, huh?
Well, I don't think they are. I'm wondering what's going on. I'm hoping it's not a water condition issue.
Well, do you think some of them just grab them and rip them up like they do the brine shrimp?
Conceivably.
Do they have a pretty hard...
They do have a fairly hard carapace, but I just don't think they're big enough to eat them. I mean, the adults scope them up with, like, nothing.
The Daphne don't know that the babies aren't big enough to eat them, and they're all hiding.
Maybe. I don't know. It was interesting to see. They were all in there, you know, and maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 Daphne in there, doing fine, but I would see the babies, some of the bigger babies, starting to chase them, but no way, they were bigger than their head, than their entire head. I mean, they were big.
So, they're probably not actually eating them.
I don't think so, but since Daphne can be sort of barometers for water conditions, I'm a little worried. I don't know. I've been doing partial water changes and stuff.
Tests.
Maybe so. But the fish seemed to be fine. The last count I made was almost 40.
You said 33?
Well, no, because I did another count, and there were more than that.
Oh, okay, yeah. Great. You said we lost, what, three or four as belly sliders?
Three or four as belly sliders, right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. They never got big enough to eat.
Poor things.
They were very small. And, and they died in the first 4 or 5 days, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, the rest of them seem to be doing fairly well, although some of them are a lot smaller than others, but that's pretty normal. You get some that eat more and just grow more. So hopefully they don't outgrow them so much that they start eating them, because that does happen on occasion. Okay, anything else? Oh, yeah, we did have that brine shrimp, that pump fiasco with the brine shrimp hatchery.
Oh, dear.
This is just a word to the wise, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody knows that when you set up a pump or any electrical device, you need to be really careful to keep water away from it, unless it's one that's submersible, of course. But had an air pump that was hooked up to two of our tanks, an Opayula tank and a brine shrimp hatchery with a gang valve so that I could separate the air streams between the two and get them both aerated. The other day, we were sitting at dinner, and we heard this weird sound.
It was like this crackly.
Yeah. And we started to smell something, too. And we looked over in the corner and found that one of the brine shrimp hatcheries, because I tried to keep two going at all times, had been knocked over, and the salt water had landed on the air pump. Because it was too close.
It was sitting in it. It was all over the...
Yeah. Which, of course, I broke the cardinal rule. You're supposed to keep air pumps out of harm's way, out of any potential of getting wet. And I did get it wet. Not on purpose, of course, but it had gotten knocked over. And I had to, you know, that pump scrapped, ruined salt water. So that's the end of that. And it could have been dangerous. I mean, it could have been quite dangerous. So.
So it was good that we were home and not out someplace.
So word to the wise, just remember to keep your air pumps out of harm's way. Salt water is even worse than fresh water for that sort of thing.
You said it conducts more?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, it has more sodium, you know, and other ions in there that conduct electricity. Mm. Distilled water doesn't conduct electricity.
Like, at all?
There's nothing to go through. It needs something to go through, but the electrolytes and, you know, the different dissolved minerals in the water will carry a current, and so salt water is worse than fresh water for that.
So, theoretically... If there was a lightning storm...
And you're standing in a pool of distilled water?
Yeah, if there's a lake, a pure lake with nothing getting in it from dirt or anything, like a big glass bowl that's the size of a lake that had distilled water in it, you could jump in there and be safe.
Well, I don't know, because lightning does weird things. It jumps along things that aren't really conductive because it can jump over longer spaces or whatever. I don't really understand how that works. But... Yeah, it's basically salt water.
You could drop a curling iron in it, and it wouldn't electrocute.
Well, I'm not going to try it.
Well, no, I'm not at all suggesting that. I'm just, I didn't know that. I didn't know that distilled water can.
If it's perfectly pure water, it wouldn't. But since water is a universal solvent, if it's sitting in anything, it's probably going to get some dissolved items in it. But yeah, the more you have in it, the more conductive it's going to be.
That's very interesting. See, I learned so much from you. I'm married to Mr. Wizard.
All right, well, let's move on and talk about the next thing, I think.
We will talk about the next thing, I think, after the break.
Oh, okay.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Now.
Okay, so now we are going to tell you about Russ's birthday present.
My birthday present.
Yes, which was not a ring of any kind.
No.
Although I guess it's, if you cut a cross section, it would be a ring. I hadn't thought about that, but it doesn't make you turn invisible.
So what did you get me? I know, but just for the benefit of our audience, what did you get me?
I got him an R2 target feeder.
Yeah. It's,
explain what it is.
Yes, it is a contraption that's produced by the company R2 Solutions. They have partnered with the folks, maybe you've heard of Fish School. We've talked about it before, actually, fishschool.com, I believe.
We should get an interview with them sometime.
We should, that'd be fun.
That'd be fun.
They have a company where they've put together this kit for training fish, and one part of that kit is the target feeder. You can buy the target feeder separately, or buy it included with the whole training kit, which includes the devices and tools, everything you need to train fish to play soccer or do the limbo and play fetch, all sorts of things.
It's pretty cool.
It is. Someday I'd like to own that, but for now we just got the target feeder, and it's been fun and interesting to use it.
You'd use it for operant conditioning.
Operant conditioning, right.
Fish.
And yeah. It can be used for other applications as well, but it's great for operant conditioning because the fish recognize it. It has a tube. What color would you say
it's
the
green.
Tube is on the outside? Green. And on the inside, when you release it?
It's orange.
You push down on the plunger and an orange little feeding compartment comes
it.
Out. Green and orange together sometimes are hurtful.
He's colorblind.
I just didn't want to say the wrong color.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's a little feeding compartment. You push down on the plunger on the end of this long wand. And when you do, it exposes the orange feeding compartment. And so the fish see the difference. They can hear it, I'm sure, too, because when you do it, there's this
little
spring
sliding.
That kind of creaks. And I'm sure they hear that. And it's not a very loud sound, but I'm sure they can hear it. And anyway, when they do that, you release the food. You can put a wide variety of foods in there. And so I immediately started using it to habituate our goldfish, two of our goldfish, which share the same tank. And it's been interesting to see. It didn't take very long for the first fish, minutes actually, to realize what was going on.
Yes, which is interesting because he's the more food motivated of the two.
He is.
Our kids call him the great hog of the ocean.
Yes, his name is Black-Eyed Susan, after the flower, because he has very black eyes, completely black. He's a shoebunken fantail.
Well, plus
not
when
shoebunken,
we got him, we had a
calico
pirate theme
fantail.
Going on in our naming of the goldfish, and we thought that, you know, that sounds like a good pirate name, Black-Eyed Susan, the hog of the ocean.
But later we found out he was a male.
Yes.
So Susan doesn't
which
fit as
figured
well,
because all of our pirate-themed goldfish that had boy names turned out to be girls.
Like Wendell and and Bert and so on.
Yeah.
Yes, anyway. anyway, where were we? Yeah. Black-Eyed Susan, no, it's okay, is a calico fantail with black eyes and very aggressive feeding response. So he took to that almost immediately, and it took several days for Pai Sho, which is our shoebunkin.
He's my fishy.
He is, and he's a shoebunkin goldfish, so he's single-tailed, and typically people associate single-tailed goldfish with a very aggressive feeding response, but he's not as aggressive as Black-Eyed Susan.
That's why we named him Pai Sho. We didn't know that at the time, but that's why it fit him.
There you go.
And I give 50 points to people who write in and tell me what Pai Sho is from. And if nobody writes in, then I'll tell you next episode.
Okay, there you go.
I don't know what you're going to do with the 50 points, but you'll get them.
Okay. Well, it was just interesting to see. It took him longer, but he got it after a few days. And now they are both very enthusiastic about the feeding wand. They'll swim to it from any location that I put it into the tank to get the food. And they're pretty good at getting it out quickly.
Figured it out.
Yeah. They sort of slurp it out when it's still sitting in the compartment. They'll just open their mouth and, you know, the current will kind of draw it in. And they do very well with that. I've also found out that when I give them other foods, like peas, you know, pieces of peas or different things like that, I can put those in the feeding one. It's good. Not only for them, but also in the past, they shared the tank with a very small bristle nose. And I've had trouble in the past sometimes getting, because it's a deep tank, 37 high. And so dropping some bits of peas in there, goldfish would get the first 6-8 peas that I would put in there, because I just want one or two to fall into a place where the bristle nose can get to them. But with this target feeder, I feed the fish a couple of them, and then I reach down and release the plunger under the plants. And they fall down there, and the goldfish don't see them falling through the water column, so they don't go for them. And the bristlenose can get them.
The bristlenose actually get something to eat.
And that's one of the other applications of a target feeder. You can use it to feed, you know, reluctant or non-aggressive feeders, or, you know, sedentary animals, or different things like that. So, kind of fun. I am enjoying having it.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
We're talking about betas and frogs now.
Yes, I have. And in my office, I had a 5-gallon tank where I've been keeping a couple of African dwarf frogs for a while now, and I thought I wanted to put a betta in with them, but the problem about getting them to eat, you know, the betta will come and steal all their food. They're not very fast. I can feed them by themselves. I can put you know, 30, 40 Daphnia in there, and they'll just snap them up. If I would have put a Beta in there, he would snap them all up before they got a chance.
You should just get you a target feeder for your office.
And that's a possibility. That could work. But I was thinking one option is to just set up another tank for Betas, and I have that divided tank that I was in the garage for a while, wasn't using it. Mm-hmm. But now I think what I'm going to try to do is put some Betas in there and leave a compartment empty. Yeah, in the divided tank. Leave one of the compartments empty, and then when I want to feed them, I'll just take the Beta out, put them in there. They can interact with the other Betas. It'd be like basically carting them, because mm-hmm. you put the Beta in between the other Betas and they can interact, and then you take them out. And then the two Betas can't really see each other because there's that space between. And I could do that a couple of times a week just to make sure that the frogs feed. So I'll feed them when he's in there, mm-hmm. let them eat, and when they're done, I'll put them back.
And they'll get some interesting playtime.
Yeah, they get some enrichment, and the frogs get food. I'm going to try that and see how it goes. Hopefully it doesn't stress the Beta out too much, because if it does, I'll have to work out something else. Something else I'm going to do with that tank, too.
Oh, a veggie filter.
Yeah. I've played with, of course, different things with plants and with Paludaria and so on, but one real benefit of planting plants that are outside of the water column is that they can use atmospheric CO2.
So they're just getting it from the air instead of having to suck it in from the water.
Right, and unless you enrich CO2 in the water, it's a very limiting factor in plant growth. But in the atmosphere, it's not a limiting factor. There's plenty of it.
That's why we have all these terrestrial plants.
Right. So you're getting a lot more plant growth for your money's worth, or whatever you want to say. A lot
more CO2
bang
for
your
buck.
In terms of how it goes. So I'm thinking of, in this Beta tank that I'll be bringing into the office, I'm going to try to install a veggie filter on it so that the view of the Betas is fairly unobstructed. But I'm going to try putting some plants in kind of the back of the tank, have some plants hanging out and growing, because I've got a big window right there. Might as well use it.
Yeah, it's south window.
It's kind of southeast, yeah, and so it's a pretty good source of light. I've got some plants in there right now, but why not do some aquaponics?
Put some more plants in.
Yeah, basically use the fish waste to feed the plants, and therefore benefiting the fish because of the removal of the waste, mm-hmm. exporting it as plant tissue, and making use of atmospheric CO2. So
everybody's happy.
Give that a try, yeah.
One more thing.
Yeah. Which is?
Our opaiula.
Yeah. Opaiula, our Hawaiian shrimp, the brackish water shrimp that live in subterranean cracks and seams in lava and so on, and occasionally surface to ankyline pools to eat algae and things like that they find in those pools. Very unique ecological niche that they occupy in Hawaii. Anyway, I've had a breeding population of them for years since we lived in Hawaii. I brought them back with me. From Hawaii, and this is an interesting thing. It's been a while since they've been reproducing a whole lot. They once in a while produce a couple of larvae, and you know, everything's fine. But they're a very long-lived shrimp. They can live up to 20 years or so. So they don't reproduce nearly as prolifically as, say, red cherry shrimp. Anyway, lately they've been going through a population boom, and I think it's partly because I've removed some. Split one tank into two, and then one of those tanks I dismantled and sold all the opaiula. And when not too long after that, they began to reproduce more, and I just had one female who produced about 16, well, one small batch of two or three, and then another female that produced a batch of about 16, which is more along the lines of what they should normally do. And it seems to have coincided with the reduction in population to some extent.
They figure there's more space.
Something like that. The carrying capacity of the ecosystem is increased because the population's gone down. Seemed to work. And now there's another female who's carrying a big batch of eggs, too. So it's been fun. But one of the fun things I'd like to mention about it is that I got some footage of the female on the day she was releasing the young. I looked into the tank and saw a few floating around. And so I looked and saw this female in there with all these babies attached to her, but they were out of the eggs, and they were moving around, and you could mm-hmm. see it. So I got a shot of the female, first of all, with the babies attached to her, but wiggling around, and then a shot of the babies floating up in the water column, and then I got a close-up of one little one floating by, so you can see it. And it's a fairly good shot. There's a little bit of algae on the glass that sort of interferes with the clarity, but it's kind of fun to see, so I'll put that up on the website, and you can check that out.
Is it already on YouTube?
No, but it will be by the time the podcast is released.
Not quite done editing it. Oh, okay. So you'll already get it.
Yeah, so you will have already have the chance to see it. I'll put it on the show page and you can check it out.
Okay, we should put it up on Facebook too.
Yeah, we can do that as well. So, here you go. We're looking forward to seeing the development of our betas as things go on. And we'll keep you posted, and we hope to hear from all kinds of you. So
ask us your fishy questions.
Yeah, send in comments, questions, anything you want. And
may the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.